Thank you for bearing with me. I just don't like those big things in front of me and the audience. Now, when Bill Carruth gave that very kind introduction of me some moments back, he overlooked one thing that I think I want you to know, and that is there is a John Goodman health policy blog. Now, if you go on the internet and you Google health policy blogs, you're going to find out two things. Number one, that the John Goodman health policy blog is about the only blog on the internet that is right of center in approaching healthcare issues. Or certainly it's the only one that gets any significant traffic. And all I mean by right of center is that this is the only health policy blog that thinks that economic incentives are important, that that's why we're having problems in healthcare, and we're going to have to pay attention to them if we're going to solve those problems. The other thing you're going to see is that this is the only health policy blog on the internet that has a sense of humor. I don't know what it is about all my colleagues in the health policy business, but they're all a bunch of sourpusses. And not only do they not have a sense of humor, but they often do not know if I'm joking. That's got me in trouble, so much so that we even have a satire alert. It's in the form of a yield sign for people who are humor challenged, so that you know, if you don't know that something's funny, we tell you anyway. We feel like if we can't make you smile once a day, we're not doing our job. And so we'll do things like we had a post the other day about how under Obamacare, all of you are going to be forced into HMOs and they're going to ration your care. And underneath it, we went out on YouTube and got Aretha Franklin singing Say a Little Prayer for You. And then we had another post the other day on end-of-life care, and we got Bob Dylan singing Knocking on Heaven's Door. Then we had poor man here in Dallas, down at Parkland Hospital Emergency Room. He went in there, and those of you from the area will remember reading about this in the newspapers. He waited there for 19 hours and died before he ever saw a doctor. And we thought this was terrible, and we also think it's happening in emergency rooms and other places around the country, and so we thought we ought to write about it. But underneath it, we had Lionel Richie singing All Night Long. Several people said, "You're being insensitive," and we probably were. Now, when Bill Campbell asked me to be in this session, I said, "Well, I don't know anything about, family, church, and school?" He said, "Well, what do you know about?" And I said, "Well, I know about health care, and I know about the welfare state, and I know about how to reform all those things." He said, "Well, you just go ahead and talk about that." So let me do that for a few moments, but I want to focus on Obamacare. This is a really radical piece of legislation, probably more radical than most of even you realize. And it's going to touch all of you. If you're on Medicare, it's going to change the way you get health care. If you're on Medicaid, it's going to change your life. And if you get insurance through an employer or you buy it on your own, you're going to be affected in big ways by this legislation. And given how truly radical it is and how much money we're going to spend, almost $1 trillion over 10 years, 159 new federal regulatory agencies, given all this momentous change, I wonder if you, along with me, are a little bit surprised about the way the president talks about the bill and the way that the White House talks about it and the way that Democrats in Congress talk about it. For example, I'm sure you've heard many times Barack Obama say, "Well, now that we have this bill that we passed, an insurance company won't be able to kick you out of the plan just because you get sick." And that's true. That's in the bill, by the way. But it's also true that's been federal law for 14 years. So it's almost like the White House went through the books and they found a law they liked so much they decided to pass it again. Then you've probably heard the president say, "Well, now that we have this bill, there's going to be no lifetime limits on your health insurance." And that's also true, and that's going to be important for the 1/100th of 1% of the population that ever has that problem. And then you probably have heard them talk about the 26-year-old child, and you're going to be able to keep, you know, the teenager who's 26 on your insurance plan. And that's going to be important for the very, very few families that ever have that problem. And then, of course, the thing they've talked about the very most is pre-existing conditions. And they've talked about it so much that you could be forgiven for thinking that's the whole reason why we have the bill. Because on the eve of the vote a year ago, every single proponent who went on television or got in any public forum, every representative, every senator, not only talked about pre-existing conditions, but every one of them had an example in his state of a family, a person that they named by name that had been abused by an insurance company. So, you know, at that time, though, we didn't know how many people there were. I mean, you just had these little anecdotes from here and there, but nobody knew how many people in the United States had a serious pre-existing condition and couldn't get insurance because of it. Well, now we know, because as of early fall last year, anybody in America who is being denied health insurance because of a pre-existing condition, for the last 6 or 7 months, everybody in the country with that problem could sign up and buy very reasonable health insurance coverage and pay no higher premium than a healthy person would pay under the new federal risk pool. And so now we know how many people have signed up. It's exactly 12,500 people. So think about that now. We passed this law. It's going to affect 310 million Americans. And the problem they talked about the most affects only 12,500 people. That's pretty remarkable that the entire focus has been on such small problems. Now, for the people who have these problems, they're not trivial. They're important. They're sometimes tragic. But in the great scheme of things, the White House is focusing on narrow, tiny little issues compared to what they're going to do to the rest of the country. My own theory about this goes something like this, that although the president says he never listens to public opinion polls, never looks at them, never pays attention to focus groups, I believe in the area of healthcare, that's all they do. You know, I remember back during the Democratic primary when every single candidate repeated two words over and over again like a mantra. It was universal coverage. That's all you heard whenever they talked about healthcare. But then when the primary was over, you never heard those words again. We satisfied the base. That's what they wanted to hear. Now you had to go into the general election. They wanted to hear about costs and access and other issues. And so a lot about cost, a lot about quality. And then we went. Then Barack Obama won the election. We zip around another year, and we're coming up on the eve of the vote on Obamacare. And every single poll that's ever been taken by any pollster has got bad news for the White House. They're saying the American public thinks if you pass this bill, costs are going to go up, quality is going to go down, so nobody believes you on these issues. So the only thing really left for them to talk about were these sort of trivial things I just mentioned. And it was almost like they get the focus group in the room and they say, look, we know all of you don't like this bill, and that's very clear, but is there any part of it you like? Maybe the 26-year-olds, how many like that? Show of hands. Okay, let's put that in the speech. And I think that's kind of the way they have been proceeding. Now, Bill, we could talk about this bill for really the rest of the day, but that would be cruel and unusual punishment for all of you. So let me just hit what I think are the six biggest problems, six things that most need repealing and replacing. If we don't do it, we're going to be in real trouble. Number one, everybody's going to be forced to buy insurance whose cost is going to rise at twice the rate of growth of your income. Now, Barack Obama didn't create the problem of rising health care costs. For the last 40 years, health care costs in this country have been rising at twice the rate of growth of their income. And we're not alone. That's about the average for the whole developed world. So all the developed countries are going up a path that's clearly unsustainable. You don't need to be an economist or a mathematician or an accountant to know that if you're buying something and its cost is growing twice as fast as your income, it's going to start crowding out every other thing you want to buy. And as a matter of fact, if we stay on this course, we'll get out to mid-century and healthcare will be all that there is. You know, our children and grandchildren will reach the retirement age and they'll have nowhere to live, nothing to eat, nothing to wear, but they'll have really great healthcare. That's the path that we're on. Now, the Obama administration didn't create the problem, but they're going to lock us onto the path. They're going to take away all the tools that people would normally revert to deal with a problem like that, higher deductibles, more limited benefits. You're not going to be able to do that. And what they're going to do is do the only thing the left knows how to do, and that is try price controls and rationing care. And they're going to force you into HMO-type plans. They're going to limit the premium the plan gets, and the plan is going to have to ration your care. Number two, there are in this legislation a bizarre system of subsidies that no one outside of my own organization has really been talking about. Folks at this hotel who are making, let's say, $15 an hour or so, We're talking about the maids, the busboys, the custodial people, the gardening people. Their total income for the year will be $30,000. This hotel is going to be required to buy an insurance plan. Family coverage is going to cost about $15,000, in other words, half again what they're being paid in wages. The hotel can't afford it. The employee can't afford it. But there is one other option. If the hotel didn't provide any insurance at all, these folks could go over into this newly created health insurance exchange. And once they get over there, the plan will be practically entirely paid for by the federal government. In fact, not only will the federal government pay total premiums for somebody at their income level, but it'll even reimburse a lot of out-of-pocket costs. So the Congressional Budget Office says the benefit over there is worth $19,000 if you can just get over in this exchange. Here at the hotel, they don't get any more help from the federal government than they have right now, and that's the ability to buy insurance with pre-tax dollars. That's only worth about $2,000. So it's $2,000 here versus $19,000 in the exchange. The economist in me tells me that I don't have to know a lot about labor law and what you can do and what you can't do. Low-income employees are going to get over to the exchange. And if this hotel doesn't figure it out, the hotel down the street will. And before we're over, we're going to have everybody who makes average or below average wages in an exchange. And probably it's going to operate like Massachusetts, with the subsidized plans paying little better than Medicaid rates. And the experience of private health insurance is going to be a little better than Medicaid. And for those of you who haven't been on Medicaid in a while, let me just tell you that in most places around the country, it's like that Parkland Hospital emergency room. You can't get doctors to provide you with care, so that's where you go to your care, the safety net hospitals and the community health care clinics. Number three, in the exchange, we're going to have terrible, terrible incentives for health insurance companies, because they're going to have to charge everyone the same premium regardless of expected health care costs. And you don't have to think about that very long to realize that if you're a health insurer, you want to get healthy people and you don't want sick people. So you try to attract the healthy, you avoid the sick, but those incentives don't stop after enrollment. In other words, after you get people in your plan, your incentive will be to overprovide to the healthy because you want to keep the ones you have. You want to attract more just like them because you're making a profit on healthy people. But you don't want sick people, so your incentives are to underprovide to them. You don't want the ones you have. You certainly don't want any more of them. You wish the ones you have would go elsewhere. These are terrible, terrible incentives for a health plan to have. They're the exact opposite of what you see on television with auto insurance. Remember the Allstate guy who's standing next to an automobile accident, and he says, you know, you're in good hands with Allstate. What he's inviting you to envision is that if you have a problem, they'll be there for you. What's going to happen in health insurance is exactly the opposite. If you have a problem, they don't want you in the plan. It's sort of like, would you want to go to a restaurant if you knew in advance they didn't want your business? So probably not. Well, I think about healthcare the same way. The fourth problem is the incentives of the people who are supposed to be required to buy insurance. If it's a weak mandate, if it's weakly enforced, and all that appears to be the case, then everybody's just going to game the system, if not everybody, a lot of people. And we see this in Massachusetts. People wait until they get sick to buy the insurance, then they get their health care, then they get their bills paid, and then they drop their coverage again. And each year, more and more people are doing that in Massachusetts. Massachusetts may be able to ride this out because they didn't have that many people uninsured to begin with. Here in Texas, a fourth of the state's uninsured, and we're signing people up for Medicaid in the emergency room. If they could sign people up for Blue Cross in the emergency room, Blue Cross is going to go out of business. This is a formula to drive private insurance out of the market. And, of course, the only thing left will be the government itself. And then problem number five is that they've way overpromised. They have, by their own estimates, they're going to insure 32 million previously uninsured people. If the economic studies are correct, all these people will try to consume twice as much health care as they were consuming before. Almost everybody else is going to have more generous coverage, including the elderly under Medicare. There's a whole long list of preventive services for which there can be no deductible, no copayment. And so when people get more generous coverage, what do? They try to go get more health care, more mammograms, more pap smears, more prostate cancer tests. The only problem is that over on the supply side, there is nothing to increase the supply of doctors. And this is exactly what happened in Massachusetts. They greatly increased demand, did nothing for supply. I remember Governor Romney telling me that once his plan passed, that we'd get people out of the emergency room and into the doctor's office. Exactly the reverse has happened. There aren't more doctor's offices. So there are more people going to the emergency room in Massachusetts today than ever before. The wait to see a new doctor in Boston is twice as long as in any other U.S. city. And in Texas, you can just, you know, triple and quadruple that the size of that problem. All over the country, we're going to have severe shortages of physicians. You'll be seeing nurses half the time rather than physicians. And it is not going to be good if you're in a plan that pays below market. And what are the plans that pay below market? It's Medicare, Medicaid, and in these newly subsidized plans, probably as well, paying just a little bit more than Medicaid. So what are people going to do? They're going to go, if they have any money, for concierge doctors. And that's already happening, but it's going to happen in a really big way in about 3 years. Everybody who can afford it is going to try to pay out of pocket outside the system for services provided outside the system. And every time one of these doctors leaves the system, he's going to leave 2,500 patients behind, about. He's going to take 500 with him, and he's going to give really good care to the 500, but everybody left behind is going to have a worse problem than they had before. So the more concierge doctors there are, the more people who sign up, the worse it's going to be for everybody left behind. And finally, it's going to be really bad for Medicare, and I'm a little concerned about that because I'm approaching the point which I may myself be on Medicare. And the White House is very anxious for none of you to know this. I mean, they've got Andy Griffith on TV, and some of you may have seen the ads where he's telling seniors how great this bill is going to be for you, and he's really not believable because he looks like he had a stroke. But anyway, you all may have seen those commercials. They are spending your tax dollars and millions of your tax dollars trying to convince seniors this bill is good for them. But the truth of the matter is that more than half the cost of the bill is going to be paid for by reducing spending on the elderly. And what I mean by that is lower fees to doctors and hospitals than what every other plan is paying. So according to the chief actuary, but before this decade is out, what Medicare pays doctors and hospitals will be below what Medicaid pays. The senior will be less attractive to the doctor than the welfare mother. And the only real question here is a political one, and that is, will Congress be able to withstand the pressure from elderly voters? If they can't, it'll just reverse all the cuts, in which case we have paid for nothing, really, in this reform. It's just more deficit spending. Or if it doesn't, then we're going to have a lot of seniors who are going to get a lot less care than they think they're going to get. This, in my opinion, is the most serious domestic policy problem. It's not just Obamacare. It's that combined with Medicare, Medicaid. Health care is our most important problem. It will continue to be our most important problem for as far as the eye can see. I can't agree with Jim Glassman, who I really like, but I can't agree with his comment at lunch that all we have to do is just quit spending on people. If it were that easy, you know, I'd tell you, you know, I'd be for it. But it's not that easy. There are solutions, but it's not as simple as let's just quit writing checks. Thank you all.